You guys can join her if you want. I'm going to call the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. Today we have continued over Senate Bill 5516. Senate Bill 5516 is the district attorneys and their deputies, the budget for each of them. We have today we're going to hear from BAM first. Marla Ray will be replacing Dale Penn today, who
Cheap imitation, knockoff.
Marla Ray will be replacing Joe Penn today, and then Doug Harkleroad will be with us, and Mr. Hartwig, I believe, is here as well. And Ms. Marquis, were you going to testify or not? Okay. So that's the agenda for today. Do you want to go ahead and start, Linda?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the subcommittee, for the record. Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Speaking from the gray document you all seem to have in front of you. On the first page, we see that the governor's budget for 2003-05 is $9.5 million. That is almost 1% lower than the close assessment budget in 2001-03 budget, and it's 0.1% higher than the budget was through fifth special session. On the next page, we see very simply that this is a totally general funded budget at $9.5 million. Page 4 repeats that the governor's budget is a 0.1% increase from the level at legislatively approved budget for fifth special session. The major changes that were approved through the special sessions included increasing district attorney salaries for the compensation plan was done last June. Deputy district attorney supplemental funding was reduced by $68,787, which was 3.6%. Beyond the fifth special session, in special session, or what we call special session 6, Senate Bill 5548 took another $120,000 reduction, so that the total reduction was 10% for deputy DAs. Witness fee supplements were reduced $205,000, and the overall reduction, as we said, was 1% down from close of session. What's included in the governor's budget is full funding for district attorney salaries, partial funding for deputy DA expenses at about $673,000. There is no funding for witness fee supplements, and there is funding for administration. Page 5 shows that for budgeting purposes, this budget is considered one program unit. As you know, it's appropriated as four separate units, or has been appropriated as four separate units. The current appropriation bill, Senate Bill 5516, appropriates as a single appropriation. That's a change from before. However, on the next page, on page 6, we'll see what the splits are that line up with what the appropriations were. In other words, personal services at $7.5 million, or about 79% of the budget, is all district attorneys. Moving to the upper left, services and supplies at $1.3 million is all administration. What was the administration appropriation? Special payments at $0.7 million is for deputy district attorneys, and that's about 7%. Moving to the next page, we begin to build the budget. The 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget was $9,563,857. It funded, of course, 36 district attorneys for 36 counties. Legislatively approved actions through April of 2002 included a reduction to witness fees of $191,000. Base budget adjustments included a $787,000 roll-up of compensation, including PERS at 20.28% of salary, and then healthcare inflation as well. Inflation is included in this budget at 3.5%. It's $81,000. State government service charges increased by $934,000. Mr. Wilson referenced that yesterday, and we discussed that this is mostly because of liability coverage, and Mr. Hartwig will be discussing that in a lot more detail later, as well as the history with it. The policy packages on page 8, the first one, package 081, was from the 2002 third special session. It's just a technical correction in the whopping amount of $320. Package 090 is a package that is used to balance to available revenue once we know what the December 2002 forecast is. It took witness fee supplements of $316,000 as well as deputy supplements of $709,000. Package 091 extends 2002 fifth special session reductions that were made in Section 2 of House Bill 5100 last September. And with the witness fee supplement reduction of $86,518, that's essentially the rest of the witness fees supplements. Deputy supplements, $569,556. That leaves a balance of $673,000 for around 300 deputy district attorneys. And finally, in administration, there was a $15,000 reduction, and that gets us to our $9.5 million budget.
Thank you, Linda. Questions for BAM? Thank you. Well, Doug's passing some stuff out. I'm going to pass some things out, too, not to confuse the budget, but I just wanted to pass out to the committee letters I received, I think, from 10 of the 36 DAs in the state in regard to the training needs, really, that they have and the services provided by Department of Justice. We highlighted these real briefly in the Department of Justice budget, but while the DAs are here, and we could also ask them about the critical services that are provided by DOJ to them, as well as the training materials. And specifically, as someone who I tried to find my search and seizure manual that DOJ produced from 1 year in the DA's office that was battered and worn and torn out. You want to pass it down the line, Doug?
Sure.
But mine was battered and abused and everything else, but you can see some of the work that goes on, but that's in reference to that. So I just wanted people to be aware of that, too, and if anyone had any questions about the training services or other things provided. But I have received letters from many of the DAs around the state in support of this particular letter. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a question whether or not a question about the loss allocation plan is appropriate to the BAM representative or whether there's somebody else here from BAM.
Later. Yeah, David Hartwig is here with us today, and we will have an opportunity to ask Mr. Hartwig about the particular piece on DASP. But what I'd like to do on the risk allocation, give Dale and Doug an opportunity to walk through the issues that we discussed yesterday and see if the committee has questions for that. Dale, are you? You're the leadoff hitter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm listening to the presentation that was made yesterday, and at least the part that I was able to be here this afternoon. I do think there are a couple of things to highlight, and then I'd be happy to address specific questions. Some of them related to the formula for deputy DA supplements and witness fees, and I'll be happy to respond to that. District attorneys are a unique officer in the state constitution and in the state. As you can see, we do not have a single agency head. We are 36 independent individuals and representing counties or the people within those counties, yet enforcing state law, utilizing state law, and initially having some state resources to do that. We're in a unique position in the criminal justice system. I think Mr. Williams described that pretty well yesterday when he spoke with you. I think the wisdom of Oregon's system is that Oregon is not a single entity where criminal justice issues or other issues are exactly the same in Eastern Oregon as they are in the coast, as they are in the valley, as they are in the state of Multnomah County. And I think all of you are aware of that. And that's why I think that the Constitution looked at having a state officer but elected by local county residents so that you could have responsiveness to those citizens. And so we have state responsiveness being state officers and utilizing state law, but local responsiveness because of those unique circumstances in that area. I think that's important to understand as we talk about our situation and the funding of that. I first started appearing in front of this group in 1985, representing district attorneys. And I can tell you that when we would have this discussion, I would explain to you, well, we have some money for drug enforcement. We have some money for gang enforcement in different areas. We have some money because the state gave us a new responsibility to attend all mental hearings. And so there's some money there for deputy DAs to attend those mental hearings. And then, of course, we had witness fees, and we had deputy supplemental monies and our personal salaries. That was the budget back in 1985. As you're aware, many of those things are no longer there. They've been stripped away. And this session now, we strip away witness fees. In actuality, witness fees is an interesting thing in that, again, when the state took over the court system, our witness fees were always in that budget. However, the state court administrator said, in simplistic terms, we aren't paying a dime for DAs. And so, costs for grand juries and costs for DA witnesses were not part of that court budget that came over to the state. And immediately, we came before this body and we said, we need funding. This is a statute that said these people are going to get the exorbitant sum of $5 a day and 8 cents a mile. And that's the same what it is today. And unfortunately, some of these people need that money just to get to court. Because many times, victims are people who do not have a lot of money to spend. And we're talking bus fare. We're talking about just the capability to physically get to court. But that statute is there. And we came before this body and said, you know, we can't give you all the money that you need. However, which is the way it was funded before, however, we're going to try to give you some. And so we got something over half of those witness fees. But next session, we're going to give you all that money. And I think Senator Tony Meeker was the chair of the Public Safety Committee and made that promise. And then for about the next three sessions, John Collins and I came back here and said, you know, we're supposed to get this money. We never got there. Then we got to the point where the state said, you know what, we can't give you all this money, but we're going to give you half of your costs. And if you looked at our budget last time, that's always been the goal, 50% of the costs that you use for witnesses. And unfortunately now, we have another situation of pulling something else off the table that assists in prosecuting and enforcing state criminal laws. So having given you that history of how we got to this point, let me briefly hit the issue of how did we get these formulas? Where did this come from? Because I think Senator Devlin may have asked that question yesterday. Why is it that in the statute we have a particular standard of how this is done? Well, I'll give you the philosophy that we developed, and this was the idea. If you are in a county where there are two prosecutors, the elected district attorney and one deputy DA, if you lose that deputy DA, you've just lost 50% of your capability to enforce the criminal law in that county. Or if in a county where there's three deputy DAs, so you lose one, that's 33%. Huge impact. So what we said back then, and back again when I started, this amount of money was close to $7,000 per deputy DA statewide. And that was 20 years ago when salaries, you can imagine, $7,000 out of a salary of a lawyer, that was a significant chunk. And the state was recognizing the need to enforce our collective laws. However, that started going down. And about 1990, we grabbed a hold of the amount that it was at that point, which was about $5,000 a deputy DA. And we said, you know, we've got to freeze this. because we're losing the capability to have prosecutors. Counties are not able to step up, and they're going to cut a deputy DA if they lose that support. So what we did was we said, let's take $5,000 a year as an amount and freeze it for the first three deputies in every county. Now, that's going to help the smallest counties. It's going to hurt the biggest counties. But percentage-wise and the capability of how many cases you can handle in that county, we think that's a fair way. And so that was the proposal, and that's what has been placed in this in our statute over the years. So the first three were given a $5,000 stipend. And then every other deputy in the state is put in a pool. And the money that's left over, you divide however many there are into that money that's left over. And instead of getting $5,000 a year supplement for that prosecutor, you're really only getting probably $1,200. Now the math is we don't give any now under this proposal. But anyway, that's how we got there. On witness fees, what we did again, we said, listen, every county has a prosecutor, the elected DA. Let's put a base level of $1,000. And I know I'm fudging with the numbers, a couple of dollars here or there, but $1,000 for every county.
How much is he fudging stuff?
$9.50.
So about $1,000 for each county. And then we said, so that's $36,000 a year for witness costs. And then, you know, the number of deputy DAs is going to be somewhat indicative of how many witnesses you're calling. Because you can't prosecute a case if you don't have a prosecutor there. And so then what we did was we took the rest of the money and we divided the number of deputy DAs into that pot of money, and then that came back out to each county. So a place with one prosecutor, the elected DA, they'd get $1,000. Everyone else, it came out to $1,000 plus X amount of dollars, however much we had. Now, that is all gone. The way this formula will work now on the amount of money that we have for deputy DA supplements is we don't get past the first three deputies, and we don't even get full payment for the biennium for those first three deputies. But it is at least still providing some protection to those smallest counties that we have in the state. But that's how that formula went out and why it's there, and at least the thinking behind
everyone
it.
Everyone recalls this. This is the one we had yesterday.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
I just wanted to thank the district attorney for that clear explanation.
Certainly. Despite the budget, you understood it.
Despite the budget. I know the budget's tight, but $9 and whatever it is, 53 cents.
Yeah, you guys are silver-tongued devils. They're used to being in the courtroom. They're used to it, so you got to watch them.
The last thing that I would note about the budget that you see in front of you is that we have asked for a single appropriation within our budget. And the reason for this is that as we have had to go through the budget cuttings over these years, we have had silos. We've had witness fee silo, deputy DA supplement silo, administrative cost silo, and DA personal salary silo. And as we have had to try to make these cuts now and pull things away, we have really lost any flexibility to deal with that. And so that is our primary reason for asking for that in this budget, that we have a single appropriation. We pretty much are down to DA salaries, administrative costs, and some portion of money for deputy DA supplements. The last thing that I would like to give the subcommittee is, I don't know if this has already been passed out. Okay. We have passed out, and I provided this to the chair earlier, but we have tried to develop a public safety coalition. And at least we started with the chiefs of police, the sheriff's association, Department of Justice, and ourselves, and looking at public safety as a whole, stepping back and saying, listen, we all have our own personal ideas, but what about this as a system? how is this going to operate in the future? And we tried to come up with some standards that we felt were very important in trying to look at cutting budgets and yet still having a public safety system that operates when we're done. And so we've identified different things. And I think the biggest thing is stepping back and saying, does this system function when we are all done? We really think that the central mission of the state-funded criminal justice system is to deal with violent offenders, career property offenders, and providing restoration to our victims. We think those are the three key concepts that are important. I won't read through each of these. I will say that, you know, you've heard testimony on the court and on indigent defense, and you've heard people from our associations standing up saying, yes, those are key concepts and important functions, and they need to be funded, and state police is important, and Department of Corrections is important. I mean, every one of these is important. But I think we do have to look at sole source situations. We do have to think about training in this process. If we are going to have a functional system that is so complex, that is reviewed so harshly, and I'm not talking about politically and in the media, I'm talking about through a legal process, that we must have people that understand the rules and are not making mistakes, because not only do you have victims that are unable to obtain justice, you have a system that is much more costly because of the mistakes that are made. At any rate, those are a couple of things I'd look at, and we think that, first of all, we do have consensus of opinion among those organizations that these are the factors that are very important that we should take into account as we try to decide, and as you try to decide, what gets funded and what doesn't get funded. But with that, I've probably taken too much time, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions or be here to answer questions later.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, that would be incredibly helpful for us to see both how the district attorneys and any other part of the system look at the overall system in terms of priorities, because that's going to be the real job we've got to struggle with, and input from the people working in the system is real important. The other question would be, and I'm not going to promise that we can restore all of this money next biennium, but we'll sure try.
Could I have it in a letter, please?
Sure.
No.
It doesn't make any difference whether we sign it in blood or whatever. But the other thing that I think we could do, and this, you talked about the silos and the different ways that the money, the way it's allocated. Would it be more helpful, even though we're doing some probably dramatic, if we just lumped it all together? And allocated to each county one lump sum, that's the district attorney salaries, the assistant salaries, the witness fees, and then let the counties have total flexibility in terms of how they were going to allocate it. Would that be helpful?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that would be pretty complex, only because the 36 DAs, we are state officers and state employees. So now we have a chunk of this money really has to flow through the state financial system for checks and benefits and things. Now, clearly, those other dollars would always go as a state check to the county. And generally, and each county might handle it differently, but those witness fee funds and deputy DA supplements went as a separate check on either once a year or quarterly. And that's something that I think easily could be lumped together. In effect, we're asking you to do that administratively by making this a single appropriation at the state level. And we think that provides some flexibility and simplicity of administration.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are you going to do, just as a question, going back to the DA supplement, you know, you can tell that there is a wide variation in swings in DA supplements.
Yeah.
I think that is predominantly due to local jurisdictions, either support or lack thereof of local law enforcement and DAs. Would that be fair to say?
Well,
you mean the salary supplements?
Uh-huh.
Chair Petridge? That depends on the relationship between the district attorney and the commissioners in that particular area, is what it really depends on, and how much that district attorney does for the county as part of the county management process, as well as being the district attorney and enforcing state law. And to some extent, it depends on how long they've been there.
Hey, Mr. Chair, if I could add, we've had situations. I mean, the statute gives the county authority to do that. Some counties, a majority of them do. Some counties do not. It is something that we've tried to look at it over the years and say, should it be standardized or should, you know, it be changed in some way? And it's really kind of just always fallen back. It is a local choice now. Leave it as a local choice. Now, for me personally, I can give you some history on it. In my county, I noticed that
you two are 8 or 9 cents
per foot. That's something completely different.
Okay. And I'm confused on what this is. Okay.
I was just going to say that I didn't receive a supplement for 4 years from my county.
I'm talking about DA supplements.
The deputy DA supplement?
Right. And and Doug are at 8 or 9 cents per person.
Right, right.
Where we have these other counties that are up at...
And that's
a buck a person.
Yeah, and that's because...
A buck 50 a person.
Yeah, that's because, Mr. Chair, we are prioritizing and putting the money just on the first three. And so in my county, we have 26 deputies. Well, they're going to get paid for three, or really 2.5 is what's going to happen. And same thing in Doug's county. In a smaller county, they're going to have a higher percentage. But
I understand. I wanted to just... point that out on how the formula works.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'll cover that a little more when I talk about it.
All right, then I'll shut up and let you talk. Go ahead.
Hi, sir. Chair Patrick, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkleroad. I'm the Lane County District Attorney. My job today is to talk about impact to the counties. I noted that yesterday Representative Butler wanted to see the groups, how the districts were group 1, 2, 3, and 4, and how our salaries were paid and how much those were. That should have been handed out to you.
That has been handed
just
out
a little bit earlier. And so I think there, unless there's a question about that.
Why don't you say how the groups were arrived at?
Okay, sure. These groups were arrived at by basically the size of the county, the caseload of the county, and sort of the span of control of the district attorney. So the larger counties end up getting paid more than the next group down, And it's not 100% precise, but it's close in those factors. Population's probably the biggest single factor in there. And that's the way it's been for a long time. And we've tinkered with the groups and tried to tinker with them some years and been successful and not others. Unless there's questions on that, I'll move on.
Representative Butler just arrived, and since this was his question,
I'll let
Representative Butler, we're on the district attorneys and their salary and the various groupings, and Mr. Harkleroad had given us a very brief explanation of what it was, and he had given us kind of cursory as to what factors contribute to which groups these particular people fall into.
Okay, I just had one question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
I'd caught this on in part as I was just coming down. The supplements that are given through the counties, how is that handled? For the deputy DAs,
for the elected DAs,
how is that handled from the counties? Do they transmit that money to the state, and then have the state go ahead and, or are those does that become an additional employee cost from the local government?
It's an additional employee cost from the local government, and you get a check from the local government. However, they do their salary, whether it's every 2 weeks or every month, and they cover all of that on the supplement.
So the states, Mr. Chair, so that in effect, what happens is that the district attorney, as to the supplement, the local supplement, becomes an employee of the county, and they're responsible for that portion of PERS and a PERS pickup when there's an unfunded actuarial liability.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the county.
We don't become an employee of the county, but the county does cover the PERS, if any, and any of the other associated employment costs there.
It has to become an employee of the county if they're giving you a W-2. That's exactly what the meaning of a W-2 is. So in that regard, you're an employee, and they're paying the employment tax. So I guess, you know, that's what I was concerned about, was is there a shift of the responsibility for the unfunded actuarial liability? There is not. Basically, the unfunded actuarial liability vests in the county at that point to the extent that they've made that contribution. Thank you.
The topic I was supposed to cover is the impact of the county, and you should all, the counties, and you should all have a document that's up in the right-hand corner that says Exhibit 1A. It says District Attorneys and Their Deputies, Analysis of Deputy Supplement Payments. If you could find that one. I know you have so many pieces of paper to look at, but that will help my explanation and move it much quicker.
Okay.
What we did through Mr. Hartung was to summarize the supplements to the counties, the witness fees that get paid to the counties as previously described, and then the last page totals that up, the two things. And the easiest way for me to do this is to have you flip to the final page, because that's where the summary is. It's Exhibit 3A. So is everybody on 3A? Well, this will show you the impact of the counties of what's happening with the reduction in the supplements and the witness fees. So I've chosen Jackson County for a strange reason. Mr. Patridge, Chair Patridge is from Jackson County, and I'll do a couple of the other counties. In the first column of 0103, that was the legislatively approved budget. So Jackson County would get a total of $103,046 in deputy DA supplement and witness fee money together. The April 2003 special session reduced that, and then the governor's proposed budget in 03-05, as presented to the legislature, reduces that to $25,563. So the impact, is the difference, is a reduction of $77,483. That's how much less money Jackson County is going to get for that district attorney's office there. Now, to move to Multnomah County, Representative Hansen, if you look at Multnomah County, this is the most disastrous of all of these, because they got more to begin with because they were much larger. And if you move across the line without reading the individual lines, the district attorney's office there, Mike Schwank, will receive $437,065 less than the 0103 approved budget initially. So I can do that for each one of the counties, but you can read those numbers there and see. And what that means is that lawyers are going to be laid off in those counties. Multnomah County, they've already done that, and they're going to do some more on the 1st of July. I know I've kept two positions open in Lane County, and I've got two more scheduled to leave on the 1st of July, and I expect those layoff notices will go out later this month or the month after that. And so we're going to lose lawyers, or we're going to lose secretaries. And we might lose a few pens and pencils, but mostly what we do is people. We're 85-90% people. So we're going to lose people.
And what does that actually mean? What a deputy district attorney does is to handle somewhere between 300 and 600 criminal cases, rough average, around the state. And you all know all those crimes, and we're just enforcing the law on those crimes. And so those cases will have to be dealt with less resource. I know in the Lane County DA's office, we have about five, for every criminal case we have, we get to spend 5 hours on it, on average, because we have 8,000 cases, 25 lawyers. Well, the Longo murder trial over on the coast, you can't do that one in 5 hours. So you got to put more hours into the murders, more hours into the rapes, more hours into the robberies, and all of a sudden, you don't have 5 hours for the shoplifting case anymore. Now you have a half an hour. You got to read it, make a good decision on those police reports, charge it as a crime, have it go to court, and have something happen to it. Boom. One time only, we can't try that case. That happens all around the state. Okay, so what's the impact of the counties? It means there's going to be less resource available to handle those state crimes. Now, I did a quick little calculation being a long time ago accountant. And at the bottom of this page, you will see...
No, you're trying to get in good with Representative Butler.
I also was dropped on my head as a youngster. I was
at the bottom of the page, you see $2,487,879 in the first column. That was the legislatively approved budget in 01-03. And the loss, or the reduction, is $1,814,733. Witness fees and deputy DA supplements combined dropped 73% between the beginning of 01 and today. So we've taken a 73% cut in those fees that, by the way, as Dale, of course, described, have been steadily going down for a number of years. That's not whining. That's just facts. And so there is a significant impact of a negative nature to the counties, and that was what I was supposed to talk about.
Sure.
Representative Butler.
I know that you'd like to accumulate these questions for the end, but...
No. This is fine.
This is a question that I keep asking you, Mr. Chair, and I Mr. Harper, I look at this and I say, what's the philosophy behind this? I noticed we looked at some numbers yesterday where they were spoken of earlier today, where the total amount of the budget for the district attorneys and your budget with your staff and overhead and so forth appear, and particularly with regard to the additional insurance or loss potential that we've got from the Department of Administrative Services, Risk Management Division. Shifting these costs, but is there some philosophy that the governor had in mind when he produced his governor's balanced budget relative to the district attorneys and their staffs, these costs?
I don't know that there was a philosophy. I see Dale Penn leaning forward, which means he may know something that I don't, represent Chair Patrick.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I'm
Representative Butler, I don't believe that there's any philosophy here that prosecution is unimportant. I'm positive of that. We've had conversations with the governor. It's the difficulty that all of you face. There is very little money here to deal with. And so what has happened over the years for us, and I mentioned this before you were able to come in, is just 20 years ago I appeared in front of this body and there were all kinds of funds there for drugs, for gangs, for mental hearings, because the state passed a statute that said we've got to go to mental hearings. And what happened? Ballot Measure 5 passes. You got to cut budgets. So they pull out mental hearings. I mean, this has been incremental over the years. And the reality is the counties have stepped up to the plate because we are really a small component of this system. And yet, just as indigent defense, if you don't have a lawyer to defend, if you don't have a lawyer to prosecute, nothing happens either. And so... the counties have stepped up, and as you know, they can't step up anymore. And that's the difficulty. I don't know of any philosophy here
that prosecution isn't important or something.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and the concern that I've got is that after we've looked at the risk management increase, and there is a tremendous increase, torts and the lawsuits in the case state have gone up, but I don't know of any budget which has taken a 73% hit in the governor's balanced budget that relates to anything relative to do with public safety or any of these kinds of issues. And that's why I'm just wondering if there was something I was missing. Has a DA tweaked the governor's nose or just what is it? I just don't understand.
Chair Patrick,
they weren't nice to him when he was the attorney general and they invited him to their conferences.
Okay.
They forgot to buy his drinks at the bar.
We've asked Marla to take care of that for us unsuccessfully, obviously. No.
No comment.
I agree with Dale that there's no philosophy to not do prosecution. I think it's just been an incremental whacking away, and we're down to where basically our budget is our salaries, a little bit of supplement left, and the administrative charges, which we have no control over. If we were going to rank these, and by the way, historically we have ranked them, and the DAs have been pretty much in agreement, our salaries come first. We would like to be paid. And then the second thing is deputy DA supplements. The third thing is witness fees. Now, witness fees in the next budget are zero right now. And administrative expense is still $1.3 million. That's because we have to have it. We don't get to cut that. We don't get to rank that. But that would be our ranking. And it's a pretty simple budget. And there's not much left of it.
Representative Hansen.
Well, a couple big picture kind of things. If you look at the total resources that we're allocating to district attorneys, your hits are probably pretty proportionate to everything else we're dealing with. It's just that, you know, salaries were funded at 100%, and
yes,
administrative costs were funded at 100%, and then so you had to make the cuts to the other programs that are getting whacked at 73%. To really understand this and to understand the differences, for example, the $437,000 that's coming out of Multnomah County, to really understand this, we'd need to look at the total budgets that the counties are putting in each area to really understand how severe of cuts those are. I've got a pretty good idea from a few years back when I did a lot of work on this issue with the Association of Oregon Counties trying to get more state funding, because philosophically I totally agree that the state should be picking up a much greater percentage of district attorney activity. The other kind of big picture thing that I'm having trouble struggling with, as we go through all of these budget cuts, when we're cutting state police, courts, youth authority, a lot of things aren't going to be done. I don't know if you need the same number of deputy district attorneys in Multnomah County if the courts aren't going to be able to deal with certain classifications of cases. And so trying to get this picture in terms of how do we reduce things proportionately throughout the system and still have, you know, 80% of the system functioning rather than different pieces of the system functioning better than other pieces. And that's any help I can get on that issue.
I can give you some, I think. Chair Patridge and Representative Hansen, to respond to that question, we have approximately 5,600 police officers in the state of Oregon. About 5,000 of those are local officers and deputy sheriffs. You have no control over those. I have no control in Lane County as to whether or not they pass a levy in one of our communities and all of a sudden they add 10 police officers. That's happening in Springfield, Oregon. Well, I know ratio-wise, for every 10 police officers they put out on the street, I need a lawyer and a secretary to handle the workload that's coming in. So, if you eliminate the state police, and I hope you don't, and I testified in support of their budget, but if you eliminate the state police, we will still have 5,000 local police officers. Now, what do those people do out on the street? Well, we have these state laws called crimes, and so they just arrest people for those things over and over again. That's what they're supposed to do. And then they take them somewhere. And where do they take them? They take them to the prosecutor's office. 5,000 police officers, about 5,600 now, bring 350 in round figures, deputy DAs and DAs and some city prosecutors, 175,000 cases to review and do something with. So you either got to stop them from bringing them to us. I call this the hourglass thing, where it dumps in at the top and then it goes down through the DA's office, the courts, the indigent defense, and it fans out into this big corrections thing where you have $955 million, which is by far the biggest single budget you're going to deal with on the public safety sector. And so ratcheting it all down, there's so many players who get to spend money, is really difficult. Now, what I think is that as long as those police officers out there, by the way, if crime is up or down, that makes absolutely no difference to a prosecutor in our workload. Whether you're reading about the crime or not, whether it's up or down, it does not matter. What matters to us and our workload is whether or not police officers are arresting people for crimes. If they don't do anything, we don't do anything. So when those police officers work, then they're going to bring them to us, and we're going to have to do something with them. Now, what the law says right now is the DA shall prosecute the crime in his or her county. It doesn't say prosecute some of the crime. It just says prosecute the crime. That's what the statute says in Chapter 8. So we look at it, try to make a good decision. And frankly, some places we're not filing everything anymore because we don't have enough lawyers to do it. But as long as those policemen are arresting people, the DA is going to have plenty of things to do in terms of filing and prioritizing. My own personal belief is that the biggest single out-of-whack thing in the state of Oregon has been jail space and the ability to hold people when you talk about balancing the system, because all around the state we've had federal consent decrees where the federal court's been running our jail saying you can only have so many people in, then you got to let them out, and that's been happening all over the state over the years.
Right. And we're really limited on time today.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Are there other questions that we can ask the DAs to bring back to us? Any other issues
people have? Mr. Chairman, I'm going to pull a pin on a hand grenade here and roll it out here. But I'm sitting here looking at these numbers, and it's going to be politically incorrect, and everybody's now listening to this thing. But I happen to be sitting here looking at a budget that's going to be headed to my committee, and it's Oregon Economic and Community Development, and from the 9901 budget, they have $130,441,000 increase in their budget. And I'm sitting here looking at these little bitty, teeny, tiny dollars, and I want you guys to tell me what you think we ought to do with that. These are mainly general fund and lottery funds, and I'm telling you, we've got to start thinking differently. I know this is going to be a controversy in your local level, but you guys have got to help us make decisions, because these dollars can be moved, and I'm going to probably get called into the other room in just a few minutes. But I'm sitting here frustrated by this process, because I'm seeing a system that must be in place that is going to collapse when I'm looking at all these dollars over here that are nice. I mean, these are nice dollars. So I'm gonna roll this hand grenade over to you. Put the pin back in really quickly and take it home and then have the discussion.
They're all independently elected. They've taken a little heat before.
Mr. Chair, could I just throw something out in response to that, Mr. Chair and Senator George? The difficulty I see is that I believe, and I know I'm biased, but I still believe that citizens think the number one priority for government is public safety. We have to be safe first. And then there are all kinds of other things we need to do, but if we aren't safe, we don't have a government. And the difficulty that I see, and why our first criteria here was, you got to step back and say, is this a functional system? Because Doug has told you, we're going to have cases. Regardless of what you end up funding here, we're going to have more than enough cases to be doing. But this is the fear that I have.
If you've read the Statesman Journal in the last 2 months, last week you would have seen an article, front page of local, on the top with headlines, and basically talked about there's a group of car dealers in this city who have binded together, and they have their own security staff now, and they have baseball bats. Because the system can't do anything about car thieves and all this kind of stuff, and so they're going to take care of the problem themselves. And as I read letters to the editor every week, people talk about we need to get guns. And that is a fear that I have. Vigilanteism kind of talk is coming forward now, where 2 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I didn't see that. I see it now. And that's why I think this system has to be prioritized. It doesn't mean that everybody shouldn't be accountable. I'm not talking about blank checks. I'm making sure that the priorities are correct, but it needs to be funded so that we feel safe.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir,
I'm going to say another politically correct thing. It must be I'm tired or something. But I lived in a place where the police wouldn't come when you called them because it was too doggone dangerous. And I've unloaded a banana clip and an M1 carbine into a cotton field because somebody had just broken into a house and threatened somebody. And so I understand that. And I don't want to go back to that way. That is a terrible way to live. And it really is a vigilante type thing. And that was my reason for bringing this up. I'm frustrated because I see this thing collapse. And I'm fearful of where we're headed. Because I'm going to tell you, when it gets back to it, I will defend my family. But I would prefer that you did it under the guise of law.
Absolutely. Me too. Because we still prosecute violent crime.
I would be the one. Hey, but you Listen, remember, you qualify for injured in defense.
Well, you can shoot them as long as you're in reasonable fear of your life, but if they're just taking your car, don't shoot them.
Okay. Don't worry. The guy in the cotton field was fine. It was considerably over the top of his head. But he didn't come back.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for coming, and we appreciate it. Thanks, Linda. All right. What I'm going to do, Mr. Hartwig is here today. I got all these people lined up, too, for the Dispute Resolution Commission. I apologize, but we're going to have to come and revisit this issue. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516, and I'm going to open the public hearing on the Dispute Resolution Commission, which is Senate Bill 5515.
You didn't come to my rescue.
I'm sorry. Don't cheat anybody over that $500 trailer.
I'm sure it crashed through there.
No.
He wants to see me on that trailer. I said, I'll bring it by Whitburn. You come here.
There will be people who are here to testify first. Okay. We can always come back and do my piece.
Well, why don't we have Mike come up real quick?
Yeah,
Jamie,
people.
Just real quick.
Oh, that's fine.
Like
you
want me to
do mine? No,
we can do yours at the end. I'll do yours at the end. Are you okay with that?
I'm fine with that.
Okay.
So you're getting Mike first.
Yeah. I've got to go to the Judiciary Committee to testify, but here's maybe the game plan for today. What I'd like to do is let Mike and Jamie give a very, very brief overview. Then I'd like an opportunity to have the people who are here from invited testimony have an opportunity to speak to the committee. And then we'll come back into the more budget detail and presentation, if that's okay with the rest of the committee. And I'm going to ask Representative Butler to chair until I can, hopefully Representative Wood has sent my bill already out, but we'll see what happens.
Mike, please.
Thank you. Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Executive Director of the Dispute Resolution Commission. With me is Jamie Damon. Jamie is the chair of our commission. I'll actually leave it to Jamie to do just a brief overview of the program, and then we'll invite our guests to come up with your permission. We've had some folks travel and like to give them a chance to speak. And I don't know if Cora or
Did you hear from you before me?
Would you like to hear from BAM?
Why don't we? Why don't we just go ahead with you,
okay.
Mike, and Jamie, and then we'll move right immediately into the invited testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Butler.
Great. As Mike said, I'm Jamie Damon. I'm the chair of the commission. I live in Eagle Creek, which is close to Estacada. I've been a commissioner since 1996, and I'm a community and public policy mediator since 1986. Chair Patridge said, we have a number of invited guests, and we have some detail to give to you after I give this very brief overview of just who we are and what we do. The way we've organized our presentation is really to hit on those two questions, is who we are and what we're all about. The commission is a 7-member commission. It was formed in 1989, and we do three things. We support and provide money to fund 24 community dispute resolution centers serving 23 counties in the state. And just for comparison, in 1989, there were 5 centers. The second thing is to provide direct service and support state agencies to resolve public policy and agency disputes. And the third is that we work with communities and agencies to develop and improve dispute resolution systems. We have no general fund. I kind of want that to just lay out there.
That's pretty good.
Our funding is from a small surcharge on some civil court filing cases. We know that you're struggling to find funding for critical services, and we know that you're asking agencies to do more for less and in some cases justify whether we exist at all. This is not a new message. In the last 3 sessions that I've been before you, I've heard a lot of the same kind of thing, and I want to just give you a few examples of how we've been responsive to that. The community dispute resolution programs across the state have been filling the gap in many communities where police forces, where we don't have as much police service, where we don't have as much support for dealing with boundary disputes or different kinds of disputes come up in the communities. These programs have been stepping in to resolve those issues and provide services for communities where, in some cases, there aren't other options or they're too costly to pursue. Volunteer mediators handle as much as 80% of current small claims cases in counties like Multnomah and Marion and Jackson County. We have been working with schools and establishing conflict resolution curriculum and peer mediation programs to help kids solve problems themselves. And I tell you, my daughter's class out in Estacada is 32 kids in third grade. And they have a peer mediation program in that school, and those kids solve the problems themselves. There aren't enough teachers for them to go and ask to help. These kinds of programs are filling that gap. We work with agencies to simplify and streamline rulemaking and policymaking and resolving public controversies in a cost-efficient and effective way, and often the most appropriate way to get to a solution that's going to work. The bottom line here is dispute resolution is the tool that Oregonians and agencies are using to do more for less. It is what we've been doing. It's what we're continuing to do. And many agencies, and you've got a letter before you from the court saying how dispute resolution is being built into court reform and the future of the courts. We've become a part of the fabric of how disputes are resolved in our state. We're part of that system.
So, with your permission, Chair Butler, committee members, again, we'd like to give the folks that have traveled here to testify an opportunity, and I appreciate you helping us do that. I think the best thing would be if we can just call them up in order here on your list, and we've asked them to keep it to a minute or less. And
if you turn to page 2 on the handout, they've got a list under of all the
people. And it's on the agenda, too.
And it's on the agenda, too. So.
So I'd like to, Carol, Jeff, and Bobby are up.
And we're just going to step aside and have them come on up.
Hello. I'm Carol Weigler. I've come from Portland. I'm have a private mediation practice, but I have been a volunteer mediation in small claims court, in victim offender mediation, juvenile court, in the neighborhood community mediations, and in landlord-tenant problems. And I've been doing this for about 12 years, and the reason I do it is that it's a totally different process than the legal system we offer people. It's a very different way to resolve problems. A legal system that you file a case, you fit the things in there, nobody usually asks anybody what's important to them, what they'd like to see happen. A mediation is a place where people come and sit down across from each other. They say, this is what really ticked me off, or this is what I need to have happen, and they craft together a solution that fits specifically that situation. Many lawsuits wind up with someone winning, and they aren't necessarily happy about it. So what I see in mediation is it does an entirely different thing than filing a lawsuit would do, and in that it's geared to what matters to them. Judge Koch at Thank You for Mediators in Multnomah County said that from his estimation, 5 full-time years of a full-time judge had been saved by the volunteer mediators that were in small claims court. So I think in terms of cost effective, it's hard to, you know, deny that, that that's the part. The other part that I do this for is that I think it teaches skills. When people sit down in a mediation together, they are helped to talk, to listen, and I think that the next time they have a problem, it might occur to them to try and solve it in some other way than waiting and either having violence or a lawsuit or whatever. So that the teaching of skills is an important part. As I said, I've done, you know, a variety of venues of volunteer mediation, and I found it rewarding to do, and I think it really does resolve problems for people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carol. Jeff?
My name is Jeff Ziemer, and I'm a junior at Franklin High School in Portland. And I've been involved in a peer mediation program for the last 6 years, but just recently in the last 2 years, I was recruited into working for Resolutions Northwest, a family mediation program. And learning the mediation skills alone has helped me grow to be a new person. My listening skills, I've noticed, have enhanced in a large amount, and my communication dealing with people helped me talk to people and understand exactly what they're saying has come from the skills. And it also mediation skills have also helped me cope well with people who are under emotional distress, knowing what to say and what not to, and how to be able to sit there and understand what they're going through. And most importantly, it's helped me deal with issues in my own life with my own family. But actually, most importantly, not only has mediation helped me grow as a person, I've noticed that mediation does actually help the families that we deal with in a great way. In one case that I've dealt with, I was dealing with a family, a mother and a son, and in their past, they had never really communicated very well. They didn't talk about their problems, and I sat down with them, and it seemed like we weren't really going anywhere. But at one point in the mediation, I remember these words very well. The son sat down and said, "That what you did really hurt me." And just the facial expression of the mother, she acted like she had never even seen this side of her son before, and it was. This experience had a really powerful impact on the mediation, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from the mother and how well they're working together on their communication skills. And overall, at the very least, mediation, it gives families a place to be together with someone, like with the mediators who want to listen to what they have to say. And because a lot of families take for granted their time that they could be talking together, so mediation gives a formal place for the families to sit down. Whether it works or not, it really helps them understand each other. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And Bobby.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Bobby Sorrell, and I'm a volunteer with Community Mediation Services in Lane County. I'm here today to support the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission and Community Dispute Resolution Centers in Oregon. After much counseling, individual and family, our family turned to mediation to help resolve the conflict that had arisen with our then 15-year-old son. It was finally Community Mediation Services that helped us to resolve our family conflict. If Community Mediation Services hadn't been there to provide an affordable service, I don't know what would have happened to our family. I saw other families who didn't know about or who didn't choose mediation become so desperate that they turned their own children away from their homes. That experience led me to desire to become a conduit for others who seek a peaceful and satisfying resolution to conflict. Without continued funding for conflict resolution services, there'll be thousands of Oregonians who have nowhere to turn and could increase rates of violence in the family, schools, and in the community. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify, and I urge you to continue support for conflict resolution services, the commission, and service agencies.
Thank you very much, Bobby. Are there questions for Carol or Jeff or Bobby? Appreciate you being here. Jeff, you're learning some lifetime skills. You're able to see, I think all three of you are able to see some resolution that has come short of actually going to violence and those kinds of things, I assume. So in that regard, you're saving the system a great deal of energy and resource. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's see, Matt and Kay and Art.
Written materials.
Please. Thank you. Are you not here?
Can I go next or not?
Okay. I guess Mike is the next one up, so Mike, join him. Okay. Matt?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. Our association would like to be on record as supporting the Dispute Resolution Commission's budget. The commission's community programs across the state do lots of mediations across the state, which all help ease the load of our court system. They also contract with several small claims departments to do mediation for them, all of which helps ease the load of the court system and also helps our client as well. I did serve during the interim on a work group looking at alternative funding methods for this commission to help improve their programs and find some stability in their funding. Again, this is just a good program. I'll keep my comments brief. We are in support of it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Art?
Chair Butler and members of the commission or committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties and would like to add our voice in support of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Program and their budget at this point. Our organization has participated in some of the dispute resolution efforts, and I would note that if you look at the cases that where they've been involved, a number of counties have been involved either in their land use kinds of systems to resolve issues between maybe an applicant and neighborhood organizations outside of the court system, and that is extremely beneficial. Additionally, I would note that one case even that was before the legislature a couple of times, and that is in on the coast in the community of Yahats, excuse me. Got the tongue upside down this afternoon. The 804-805 road situation, and I can recall bills in the legislature two sessions. Those bills didn't pass, or in fact, I believe one was vetoed. But the point is it was the dispute resolution program that finally brought all the parties, including Lincoln County, to a place where they could agree. And so there is much value in this program, and we urge you to continue it.
Thank you very much. Judge Mike?
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. I am Mike MacArthur, Sherman County Judge, and in this role, Commissioner of the Dispute Resolution Organization. I'm a great believer in community-based problem-solving, interest-based negotiations, collaborative problem-solving. Got involved in a couple of really big issues. I remember a few years ago there was a dust storm up by Pendleton and a bunch of people got killed, and the governor asked me to go out there and convene a community group to try and find some solutions to that problem. And without being very well trained as a mediator, we managed to pull together a good plan that's helped avoid those problems in the future. Another large-scale project I was involved in was the location of the Klondike Wind Farm in Sherman County, which uses similar principles. I learned about dispute resolution from seeing that there was an allocation of funds being set aside for each county, and I tried to determine how Sherman County could get those services. It appeared that the amount of money that was set aside for Sherman County wasn't going to buy very much. So we joined together with four other counties and were able to start up a center last year. It's called the Six Rivers Mediation Center. And I was intrigued enough by that I went through the training, the certified training to become a mediator, and I realized what powerful stuff this really is. The techniques that are taught to the mediators, the processes that they use are really effective. It seems to me to be a great program. I brought an orientation back to my county commissioners and county staff and had them see what this process was. They were so impressed by it that yesterday when I asked for a donation from our county court to the mediation center to help it keep going, they were able to dig into our litigation fund. We haven't been sued this year, so we had a little money left. And we put up $1,000. So the $200 that Sherman County was putting into the pot was leveraged $1,000 from our local government to help keep this center going because we believe it's so important. It just seems to me that this is a very important way at this time of difficult budgets in the state to keep a program going that's a great investment. This, to me, is just smart government to keep a program like this going. I think it's a very important to see this spread throughout the state. I see Malheur County's considering a program that's being developed there. I'd very much like to see this program be across the state, but we need that little bit of seed money that comes from the court filing fees in order to leverage the other funds that helps the program become established. So appreciate your support for the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Matt or Art or Mike? Thank you. Appreciate your being here and your testimony. And then Chris, Willie Tiffany, and Andrew Bowman.
Mr. Chairman, Chris wasn't able to be here, but he asked me if I would read a statement.
Okay, yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dale Blanton. I work at the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. Chris Jarmer asked if I could read this. Says he doesn't have prepared remarks, but feel free to mention that I would have testified in support of an alternative to solving our natural resource issues via the courts. Both solutions are expensive and often not what is best either for society or the environment.
Thank you very much, Dale. Willie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. The League has been involved with the Dispute Resolution Commission through work groups and their processes, and are fully supportive of their budget. In fact, in the last 3 years, I've participated in, or excuse me, last 4 years, participated in three work groups that were facilitated by the Dispute Resolution Commission, three very controversial issues that did receive consensus at the end of the day by all groups at the table. And safe passage through the legislature. One of those I just want to highlight was the Fish Passage Task Force, which was a very controversial issue right here at the legislature. Fierce battles, political battles were fought over 4 years to basically a stalemate before the Dispute Resolution Commission came in and facilitated a task force. And I, as a task force member, I think if you asked anybody else on that task force before the first meeting if they thought that anything productive would ever have come out of that task force, they would have said no way, given the history of the issue. However, at the end of 2 years, we did come up with a new fish passage policy here in the state. And, Mr. Chair, specifically as a Ways and Means issue, that issue in particular would have cost billions of dollars for not only municipalities, utilities, agricultural landowners, and the state of Oregon, who operates many of these facilities. All of those issues and decisions were avoided through the dispute resolution process. We were able to not only not have that bad economic result, but have a positive economic result and have a positive environmental result at the end of the day. So we're very supportive. That's just one example, but we're very supportive of the program and hope you are too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Willie, Andrew?
Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Andrew Bowman. I'm with the organization Defenders of Wildlife. Our office in Oregon is in West Lynn. I'd like to talk to you about a process we were involved in that actually Willie was a part too, part of it as well. As part of legislation enacted in 2001, the Oregon legislature directed the Departments of Agriculture and Forestry to take a comprehensive look at incentives for private landowners in Oregon. The agencies were directed to complete this review in consultation with other relevant state agencies and public and private organizations. The legislation also directed the agencies to report back to this legislature. In May 2002, the Departments of Agriculture and Forestry convened the Conservation Incentives Work Group to comply with the directives of the legislature. The work group consisted of a diverse set of stakeholders that included farmers, ranchers, timber producers, local governments, conservation organizations, and many state and federal government agencies. Importantly, the work group was assisted by professional facilitators made possible by a grant from Oregon's Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program. As a result of the facilitators' leadership and hard work, the work group tackled and reached a consensus on many difficult and potentially divisive natural resource issues. In February 2003, the work group issued a comprehensive 44-page report of recommendations for improvements to incentive programs and particular regulatory schemes in Oregon. Members of the work group also drafted proposed legislative text to implement the recommendations, and two bills will be introduced shortly, hopefully next week, for the legislature's consideration. Without the assistance of the facilitators made possible by the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program, it is unlikely that such remarkable results would have been attained. We urge the subcommittee to continue to support this collaborative and proactive approach to public policy development. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Willie, questions for either Andrew or Willie? Thank you very much. Let's see. Last person on the list here is a token guitar player. Oh, John Chandler. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Chandler, Legislative Advocates here without guitar. Very briefly, I have a number of clients that have participated in ODRC processes over the years, almost always with very good results, and as you've already heard, oftentimes on cases that have been in front of the legislature, sometimes through several sessions. One, for example, dealt with the issue of skinny streets from the real estate standpoint, whether or not how you build subdivision streets, which, as some of you remember, was a bill for about two or three sessions on torturing the firefighters on that kind of thing. This last interim, they worked through the commercial industrial lands process with us. That's resulted in came out of a bill last session. It's resulted in the industrial land supply bill this session, Senate Bill 467, which will be in front of you shortly, which will provide some, I think, necessary land for economic development. And it was a direct result of this commission's work. And the thing I want to leave you with today is how important it is. I'm a lawyer. I'm kind of a recovering lawyer, but I still am a member of the bar. Most public policy issues ought not be litigated. They're not right and wrong answers. They're competing goods. They're competing ideas. A process of mediation helps people get to the real issue at stake, which is what's important to them, not the technicalities of the over the and all the other malarkey that lawyers do. And we have a system and land use and environment in this country and in Oregon that is far too over-litigated, and a program like this allows the participants a chance to, as it was already said, sit across from each other, find out what's really at stake, and work towards a common set of objectives rather than going off and trotting up the court system. It's a very good program. It costs the state nothing in terms of general fund. It saves the state millions in terms of general fund. I can't emphasize enough how important it is from the private sector standpoint to have this open to us as a way of getting around agency problems and litigation. I urge your support. Be glad to take any questions.
Questions of Mr. Chandler? Any requests for special music?
Anything by Burl Ives.
Burl Ives. Thank you. Big Rock Candy Mountain coming right up. Did you have a question?
No.
Oh.
I'm not my guitar.
I want to make a selection, actually.
Thank you very much, John. Let's see. Now we can come back up to the top, and we'll come back up to Robin Lamont, and then request Mike and Jamie to come back up, too. Thank you very much for your participation. Robin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have a handout in front of you, and Mr. Effinger, you will note that the date is correct on it.
The date is correct on this one, yes, indeed. Thank you, Robin.
As a result of some actions that were taken by the last legislature, there are three budget notes that commission was asked to deal with. The last legislature removed a process whereby some of the filing fee surcharge revenue came into the commission and then went to DAS, and then DAS paid for or partially paid for coordinators in several state agencies to provide assistance with community dispute resolution, public policy dispute resolution issues. The last legislature consolidated all of that activity within the Dispute Resolution Commission, and there were two budget notes that directed the commission to report back on how they were going to implement that revision and how the process was established, which they did in November of 2001 and November of 2002, and I have attached copies of the minutes from those presentations. There was another issue that was raised by this committee last biennium, which had to do with how local community dispute resolution programs are funded, and the ODRC was directed to work with the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee on evaluating how the fees are used and recommending whether there should be sliding fee scales, whether there should be statutory change on how the fees were distributed, and that type of thing. And I believe that that report is attached to the budget binder from the commission.
Special report?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was a Secretary of State audit report in, it's fairly recently, and I have a copy if anyone would like a copy of that. There were no fee adjustments. The vacancy report will be provided by LFO when we go into work session. The agency has just completed a prioritized list of services. I did not make copies available. Okay. And ODRC will present their management staff ratio information. Some of this information in my PowerPoint handout has been provided already in summary by the chair of the commission. So in the interest of time, I'm going to point out what I think is the significant issue that we have in front of us with regard to this agency, and that is the graphic on page 4 that shows what the Judicial Department is projecting in terms of the revenue for ODRC this biennium, and as you can see, it is a significant drop. If that revenue projection holds out, the projected revenue is not sufficient to support the governor's budget, and I believe Cora will briefly talk to you about some of the ways that that will be dealt with. And then there are two policy option packages that you will need to consider, including the transfer of a position from DLCD, which is currently funded within this agency.
We're catching up with you. We're trying to catch up with the paperwork here.
Okay.
Sorry.
Over in the DA's.
Okay.
Some of these, they stick them in their DA folder.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Right, here I am blissfully moving along.
Moving on to number 4 here. Sorry about that. Right.
All right.
You were always ahead of the rest of the class.
Sorry about that. Have you all found the graphic on page 4 I was
right.
talking
yeah.
about? And then.
Did I just take your coffee, by the way?
It's fine. I have another one. Obviously, I am reading from it. And there. The issues are the insufficient funds to support the governor's budget and the policy option packages, which are the transfer of a position which is currently in DLCD, will be abolished and transferred to ODRC. This is pretty much a technical action because the funds already come out of ODRC's budget, and then there's a reclassification package and increase in FTE for their program manager position. And I think that completes my summary, unless anyone has any questions.
Anyone have any questions? All right, so we're going to let Cora take us down the walk.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division. You should have in front of you the typical notebook-looking budget management report. Does everyone have a copy in front of them?
We got it.
Okay. Moving to page 2 of that document, you just see an overview of the commission's budget, both from 99-01 through to the 2003-05 governor's proposed budget. The governor's budget is $2.6 million, roughly. That is all other funds. You will note that, as the chair of the commission mentioned, there is no general fund in the governor's proposed budget this biennium. The budget is an increase of about 3.1% over the fifth special session level. If you move to page 2, you'll just note that this budget is entirely other funded. Again, as mentioned previously, the revenue source here is largely filing fee surcharge on a number of different cases. 50% of the funds are dedicated to county programs and go out in the form of special payments from the commission. The other 50% in a 30-20 split goes to both public policy dispute resolution services and to admin or community dispute resolution services within the commission. And we'll look at that again in a minute. The next page, again, is a bit repetitive, just noting what was displayed by numbers on the first page. I do want to point out that where we say there was a 3.1% decrease on this page, that's actually a typo. It's a 3.1% increase. Again, major changes from the fifth special or through the fifth special session level. The general fund that this agency did have in their budget at the beginning of 2001-03 was eliminated in the second special session by the legislature. Other programs or packages that are included or supported in the governor's budget include a partial consolidation of what were previously cluster coordinators out in agencies. Robin mentioned that the 30% funding had originally been in DAS and went out to pay for these cluster coordinators. This biennium, the funding was still coming out directly out of dispute resolution, but the bodies, the positions were sitting out in agencies, basically being funded by professional services. The commission proposed basically bringing those positions into the commission itself, bringing them onto personal services budget, and the governor's budget partially supported that. Also, there's a support of a community program reorganization piece. The next page here, again, just talks about the split between dollars going out to community centers and dollars that are staying internally to the commission and going to public policy and community oversight. Again, the next page splits this in a little bit different way, showing that the bulk of the dollars in the $2.6 million budget are going out in special payments, about 15% are in services and supplies, and 34% go to personal services for the commission. The legislatively adopted was just under $2.5 million total funds, for the commission. Actions that were approved, in addition to elimination of that general fund component that I spoke about, there was an e-board approval of a grant piece for $225,000, and that was the equivalent of 0.30 full-time equivalent position related to that package. Other base budget adjustments for the commission include the roll-up, basically, of position actions and compensation changes. Essential packages result in a reduction of $23,165 other funds. That largely is a result of the phase out of that Hewlett grant that was mentioned. There is an inflation component that offsets that phase out of that program. That inflation component is actually just over $82,000. Moving to the last page, you see the policy packages that were supported in the governor's budget. Package 101 is that partial public policy program reorganization. As Robin mentioned, it really is more of a technical issue. There are no additional dollars here. We're just bringing the position into the commission and paying for it directly out of commission personal service dollars rather than paying DLCD to have the position on their budget. Package 102, which is a $102,689 other fund increase in appropriation and a half-time full-time equivalency. Also, we've got some dollars here related to three-year-old funds, which we'll probably discuss at a later point in time, to send out in special payments to counties. Under fee or revenue changes, I just make a couple of points. The governor's proposed budget does not include general fund for this commission. In the past, they have had ranging from small to fairly significant dollar of general funds supporting the agency, and the decision was made that the governor would no longer support that in the current biennium. We also, at the time we put the budget together, only approved a portion of the agency's proposed public policy program reorganization. And at the time, the thought process was that the governor needed to have some more deliberation of how we do that, of how we possibly pull dollars in from other agencies. There are some agencies that are willing to basically pay dollars into the commission to support certain services. And then the filing fee revenues were not entirely used at the level that they were available at the time of the governor's budget. As Robin mentioned, however, subsequent to that time, a number of actions have occurred in the judicial system that have resulted in a projected revenue forecast significantly less than what was available at the time the governor put his budget together. So instead of coming before you today and offering up a technical adjustment for how we would continue this public policy reorganization, instead we're here today saying that there are basically two roads we could walk down. One is how to live within this revenue stream, and we've actually done some work with the commission to talk about that and what services you do and do not get based on living within that revenue stream, and also continue. The other option is continuing to work with the committee, with LFO, with agencies on how to put the right dollars on the table in the right places, and continue to do the level of services that the agency has been doing. So, I guess we're sort of forthright and honest in saying we know that the current revenue system does not support the governor's budget. We also know that there are many unanswered questions as far as where the judicial budget will or will not be, and we recognize that we'll need to work with LFO and with this committee in solving that.
Thanks, Cora. Questions for BAM? Representative Hansen.
Well, that shortfall, and I don't know whether this question for BAM or for Robin. Mm-hmm. The shortfall, that's anticipated based on, like, which level of judicial support? Is that based on the governor's budget?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that is the revenue that's based on the governor's recommended budget. That is the revenue forecast that we're currently operating under. That is, it's included in the Office of Economic Policy current revenue projections.
Just to follow up a little bit on that response, subsequent to putting out the governor's budget and working with the Judicial Department and how they would live within that budget, they've identified where those dollars would play out, and that really then rolled into this program. So, I don't want you to think that at the same time we were putting the governor's budget on one hand, saying, oh, we want this higher level for dispute resolution, that we were fully aware of the revenue situation dropping on the other side. I think we knew there would be consequences, but they hadn't fully played out at the time that we were putting them together.
I should, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I should clarify that this is based on the March forecast, which obviously wasn't available when the governor put together the budget for this agency.
And we had them in, if you recall, we had the forecast in here in regards to criminal fines and assessments, which should give us a better idea of how this all would play in. Other questions for BAM? Thanks, Cora. This is going to be a tough one to wade through, so we're going to have to take a look at where we're at in light of the current situation. Mike, see if you can, what's the committee's pleasure in terms of, do we want to run a few minutes over and get this done today? If we can do it in 20 minutes, 15 minutes?
Yeah, I've got 3 o'clock BRS, but that's fine.
Okay, everyone's got 3 o'clock. So we will we'll continue to get as much as we can now, Mike, then, and we'll ask you to come back on Monday.
Chair Patridge, committee members, again, Mike Niemeyer, Executive Director of the Dispute Resolution Commission. I did go to the Evelyn Wood School of Public Testimony. I'll present the entire agency budget here in 5 minutes and get you out of here. You've got a PowerPoint in front of you. I'll just hit the highlights. I think the testimony you just heard spoke to really the value and kind of work that we do.
jumping to slide on top of page 3, we have basically this program's organized into 3 major goals. We help, as Jamie mentioned earlier, support community dispute resolution programs, ensure the successful resolution of complex public policy disputes, and help ensure efficiency of agency dispute resolution systems. We have 2 major programs, the Community Dispute Resolution Program that distributes about $500,000 roughly per year in grants directly to the 24 community dispute resolution programs that are operating throughout the state. We provide technical assistance to those programs and also statewide systems development. By systems development, Cora mentioned earlier we had a $250,000 grant from the Hewlett Foundation. This is a national grant. Because of the quality of the program that we have here in Oregon, we're able to draw resources from outside the area. So this was a project that went only to Oregon and only to the commission here. It's that kind of program development work that we're identifying there. And then we have the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program, and as you heard, involved in a wide variety of complex public policy controversies. We help both at the case level involving those difficult cases and work systematically to help agencies to incorporate ADR into their systems. And when we get to that point, Dale will testify to that, whether it's today or elsewhere. On page 4, we've got a slide there that talks about different revenue streams. You can see the bulk of it, as mentioned earlier, is from filing fee surcharge. We also get grant funds. We have private fees and contracts. We've got a project going right now where we're being paid to assist the parties in that controversy. And we have contracts and arrangements with other agencies to help provide some additional support. The slide below shows that with respect to the filing fee revenue, that there's a 50, 30, 20% split. So the surcharge on court filing fees that comes in from a wide variety of different filings, 50% goes directly back to the counties in the form of grants. 30% goes to support community programs statewide and for administration of the program, and 20% goes to the public policy dispute resolution program. We've got a couple of slides there that show our organization. Just the highlights there, 0103, we had 7.3 FTE, which included positions that were out in other agencies that were part of the program. And then if we jump to the governor's balance budget, which is on whatever page number we're calling that, you can see that we have 6.5 FTE, and as was mentioned earlier, basically moves the position that was over at DLCD and being paid by us over to the commission, but overall reduces the total number of FTE to the program. The overall stats on the community dispute resolution side, you heard about some of the quality of the services there. Just to give you an idea of the numbers, there's about 6,471 cases per year being resolved by these community dispute resolution programs, 18,779 people served. And these programs leverage not only the local community contributions, as you heard Mike MacArthur allude to, but also leverage a significant number of volunteer hours. These are programs that the community likes to get involved in, and so they're substantially operated by volunteers. And there's a lot of training that goes on, 763 trainings per year that these programs are providing. The types of cases, again, you heard some of the things that these programs are working on. Neighbor-neighbor disputes, small claims-type cases are fairly significant, family and parenting issues, victim-offender dialogues, restitution issues there, and complex public policy or public policy issues. In some cases, they deal with maybe liquor licensees or certain kinds of land use disputes that the community programs would actually get involved in. There's a chart here. It's a map of the state that shows where there's coverage. About 93%, and this is at the top of page 7 if you're following along on the PowerPoint. About 93% of Oregonians have access to a community dispute resolution program, but the eastern Oregon rural areas are not as well served. We have the new startup program that Judge MacArthur referred to, the Six Rivers program up there in the Sherman-Gilliam Wasco area. Interestingly, Mall here is one of the new potential startups that we're looking at. They've made inquiries about getting a program going. So you can see some of the idea of the coverage there. And then that just brings me to the public policy dispute resolution program. And there, I guess, I just started a preamble to Dale's presentation, and that is, as you know, state agencies are involved in thousands or tens of thousands of conflicts every year. A huge area of cost are those conflicts that aren't handled well. The conflicts themselves are destructive, and sometimes the processes that government uses don't help. They're inefficient. ADR is one of the tools that agencies have for managing conflict, and our role is to help agencies use that tool effectively, both in individual cases and systematically. So I've got two more charts here, and assuming I'll get some kind of sign when you're going to pull the plug here. But the two charts I've got, one shows agency resources used to manage conflict. I think this is kind of an interesting chart. This is a survey of agencies that are over 50 FTE. As you know, litigation is a huge cost for agencies, but what this shows is that the real costs of conflict are a little more complicated than that. There are a number of areas where agencies spend significant resources in resolving disputes. Our program helps in each of these areas, and we'll, when we have an opportunity to talk about some of the different kinds of cases that reflect those costs and the potential savings there. Underneath that, you see a chart. This came from data that I worked on when I was over at the Department of Justice that shows the relative costs. What does it cost to resolve a case that's in litigation and mediation versus going through judicial settlement or the other avenues that are available? That was a rather rigorous study that shows you the relative cost benefits of making appropriate process choices and using collaborative processes. And then finally, I think before Dale does his thing, the last chart here, as you can see one, and this is taken from the financial fraud section, but it highlights a good system design. And I show you that because we understand the efficiencies within individual cases, but it's important to look at agency systems or dispute resolution as a system, and that the efficiencies of an individual case are multiplied. What you see here is a healthy system in that most conflicts, in this case 124,000 consumer complaints, are handled through a very informal telephone process. And at the very other end of the spectrum, there's 19 lawsuits that come out the other side of that. And in between there, you see collaborative processes and some kind of staff processing. This is the kind of dispute system design work that we do with agencies to look and see not only are they using mediation, but are they using collaborative processes and dispute resolution efficiently to have a healthy system. And at this point, I would be transitioning to have Dale explain to you a little bit more about the public policy program. Would you like to?
Dale, why don't we, I know everyone's got stuff going at 3 o'clock. It sounds like the point in the session we're in, it sounds like they need to get to their 3 o'clock. So if we could ask you to come back briefly Monday, and we will take probably no more than 20 minutes on Monday. Okay. At this point in time, I'm going to continue the hearing over on Senate Bill 5516 until Monday. And any other further issues? If everyone looks, we have the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST, on Monday and Tuesday of next week, and the Criminal Justice Commission next week on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm still not clear, and Gary probably knows, and Tom, on what other things we're going to provide to the co-chairs in order to provide them the materials that they need for the co-chair's budget. So I may try and condense those hearings so we may be able to have something on Thursday in regard to committee priorities and what's going on, and maybe help take a look at the priority list and some ideas we may have within the public safety budget. At this point in time, we are adjourned until Monday.